And tonight on Coast to Coast, Leonard Mlodinow is back. We are going to be talking about his latest work, Subliminal. We'll also talk about A Brief History of Time that he co-authored with physicist Stephen Hawking. All that is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Leonard Mlodinow back with us. Leonard, always a pleasure. How are you?
I'm great, George. How are you? It's good. Nice to be back.
What is new with you?
Oh, just working, writing books as usual.
And you write very prolific, my friend. Very good.
Thank you.
We'll talk about Subliminal next hour. In the other book, of course, A Briefer History of Time, that you co-wrote with Stephen Hawking. How did that all come about for both of you?
Well, he had read an earlier book of mine called Euclid's Window, which was about curved space, the whole idea of curved space and how it, starting with the Greeks to present time and how it came to be and how it's used in physics. And he liked that, and he was looking for someone to write with. And one day I just got a phone call, and my agent said, hey, would you like to write a book with Stephen Hawking? Because he'd like to write with you.
I love it.
So I said, let me think about that. Okay, yes.
He said a few years ago that we should be very careful about sending out messages in case extraterrestrials pick up on it and come back here. He was pretty concerned about that. Was he doing that, Leonard, just to kind of be a jokester, or was he pretty darn serious about that?
Oh, no. We've talked about that many times, and he's very serious, and I think it makes a lot of sense. If you think about it, suppose we go to another planet, and when we land there, we find, you know, lower life forms, squirrels, pigs, cows, kinds of animals. What would we do? You know, what would we do? We'd use them as our pets. We'd eat them. We'd, you know, use them the way we use animals here, right? And now imagine that some other beings, aliens, are advanced enough to come to the Earth. Well, they're, you know, likely to be far, far more advanced than we are. And when they interact with us, they might see us just the way we see cats, dogs, cows, cattle, pigs, and they might treat us that way. So it's a pretty scary thought.
What's going on in the world of science these days, Leonard? I mean, you can't pick up a newspaper, watch television, listen to the radio without hearing some new story, some new find.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. You know, the number of scientists, the number of papers scientists write has been growing exponentially, and with the communication abilities that we have today and the way information is traded, it's pretty amazing. And, well, you know, one of the exciting things is quantum computing. I don't know if your listeners have heard of that, but in the 40s, scientists developed what became the computer that we know today. And, you know, when I was a kid, we went to the moon and we used a, you know, big fancy computer on the spaceship then. And you know, today, that computer, you have the equivalent of that computer in your watch, you know. And it's far less powerful than what you have in your smartphone, and that's the way computing has been growing. But there's a limit to that, and the limit to that is because as we shrink things down, we're going to run into quantum mechanics, where quantum mechanics has to be taken into account, and we're not going to be able to continue increasing our computing power. But now physicists have a new idea called a quantum computer, which takes advantage of quantum mechanics, and it lets you, in a sense, do computations in parallel, in as one physicist described it, in parallel universes that where the computations are all different parts of the computation are taking place in a virtual way, and they're all coming together to get your answer. And it's hard to explain, but it's infinitely more powerful than a regular computer. And just to show you where that's going, because I remember just 5 or 10 years ago, I was thinking, well, this won't happen in my lifetime, and it's a kind of a pipe dream, but you know, Google and NASA just announced a cooperative agreement where they're going to start a quantum computing lab. So I think companies are starting to see that this could be real and could revolutionize computers in the near future, maybe 10 years, 20 years. But to me, that's the near future when you look at it, a revolution like that.
I think so, too. It's going to be a dramatic change, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the dreams of computation has always been artificial intelligence, and I don't think we've gone very far in that. I mean, we have computers now that can beat the best humans at chess or at Jeopardy, and that, you know, that if you talk to them, they'll sound fairly human or real to you. But those are computers that are designed; they're not really intelligent. They're designed for a specific task, and they're just throwing computing power at it. But a computer that's an all-purpose intelligent computer that can act as a human does and interact with you is still far away, but quantum computing could eventually help us get that.
Are scientists still kicking around the strong possibilities of these multiverses?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I wrote A Briefer History of Time with Stephen, and then after that we wrote The Grand Design, which was largely about that idea. And it's not that physicists said, hey, what if there's, you know, multiple universes? What does that mean? Or can we use those in our theories? It's more that theories that physicists have been led to as we've looked at the data from astrophysics and our theories of how the universe might have begun has led us to that prediction that there are other universes. And so that's really, if you look at in cosmology today, that's a feature of most modern theories of cosmology.
Well, the fact that science was able to decipher this, and would they do it through string theory? Did that help them?
Well, string theory is one element of that, and string theory is an attempt to unify all the forces of nature. And we have a very, very successful theory for three of the four forces called the Standard Model, and you know that's what the big accelerator in Geneva was built for, the LHC. And that theory works very well when it comes to electromagnetism and the strong and weak interactions that take place inside the nucleus. But it doesn't include gravity, and string theory is an attempt to include gravity and to form a unified theory, you know, Einstein's dream, a unified theory of all the forces. And one of the predictions of string theory is that there are these many universes that exist, and they all have different laws. So physicists used to try to explain why the laws of nature are what they are. But a lot of physicists think today that actually there is no logical reason, no demand that comes from nature or from logic that would specify the laws being what they are in our universe today, but that there are many, many different possible laws, and that these different universes exist with all these different kinds of laws, and we just happen to be in a universe that has the laws that we have. But, you know, one very interesting aspect of that is that when we do models of how the universe would have evolved using the laws that we have, and we make tiny tweaks to them, say we change the mass of the electron by a few percent or the electric charge by a few percent, or you change the strong or the weak force by a little bit, we find that the universe does not develop, if the laws had been like that, it would not have developed in a manner that would allow life as we know it. So we live in a very special, almost miraculous universe today that has the laws of nature fine-tuned almost so as to allow our presence. And, you know, there's different ways of looking at that. If you're a religious person, you might say that, well, that was God's design. But now that physicists are discovering that we seem to think that we need these other universes for our theories to work, we're looking at it a little bit differently, and we're saying, well, the reason that we live in a very special universe with laws that allow us to be here is that in all those other universes that exist, there's no people there because the laws don't allow them to be there. Obviously, we will exist in a universe that allows us to be here.
I think when we were talking about The Grand Design some time ago when it came out, we were talking about the Stephen's views and your views about the creator, about the God possibility.
Yeah, we did. And that's that? Always a lot. Yes, I do remember. And that's always a lively discussion. And that book got a lot of attention because people saw it as us, in particular Stephen, saying that that there is no God. But that's not what the book said at all. It just said that we don't need a God to explain the fine-tuning of the universe or even the creation of the universe, that the current laws of physics could allow for a universe that comes from nothing.
But who do you think put the order in the law of physics?
Ah, so that's the key question. Yeah. And, you know, that's always amused me that people were very upset or, you know, very passionate about the question of whether the universe could come from nothing. But what you asked is really the key question that goes beyond that, because when we say the universe could come from nothing, we're starting from maybe from nothing in terms of material nothing, but we're starting from certain laws of physics, right? If you're a physicist, anything that you say starts from some laws that we believe are true, right? In this case, the laws of quantum theory and general relativity. And one could always ask then, okay, well, those laws say that a universe could come from nothing, but who made those laws and who makes those laws give order to the universe? Who dictates that? And of course, we can't answer that. As a physicist, you start with the laws, and the rest is philosophy or religion.
Well, that's true too. It's going to come down, Leonard, as one of those questions that mankind may never get the answer for, even though he's going to keep looking for it.
That may be. It's certainly not going to come from physics, because physics can't go beyond saying these are the laws that we observe, and let's find their consequences. I mean, I suppose that if physicists had been able to fulfill Einstein's dream that there's only one set of laws that logic allows, we'd be a little bit closer. But then you could say, well, why is logic? Why is mathematics exist? Why is it that way? And so you could always go beyond that. You're always starting from something. And so physics can answer that question.
What do you think Hawking would be talking to Einstein about if they were together?
Wow, that's a great question. He'd probably explain Hawking radiation to Einstein. See, the thing about Einstein, first of all, I have to say that Einstein was really one of the founders of quantum theory, one of the most important people in the development of quantum theory, even though his reputation in the media today and popular culture is that he was against quantum theory, and he later was a doubter, and he didn't like the probabilistic chance aspects of quantum theory. But he was really one of the founders. But the problem with his relativity is that it's not consistent with quantum theory, and we still don't have a theory. We're working on string theory, and a lot of people think that will be it, but we don't have a theory that we've developed fully that combines quantum theory and general relativity. And what Stephen did in the 80s with his famous Hawking radiation was he took a little bit of this, a little bit of that, combined pieces of quantum theory and pieces of Einstein's theory, and applied it to black holes and showed that black holes do evaporate. They eventually get smaller and smaller and then will disappear. And I think that he would probably be amused to talk about that idea with Einstein.
Leonard, do you think more and more people are fascinated with the universe, with space, where we come from, why we're here? I think it's growing.
I think it is. I think that those are questions, of course, that people have always asked. But what's different today is that we have such great technology, satellites and telescopes and accelerators that give us much more knowledge and information about the universe than we've ever had before. And so, we can see pictures of the early universe and colliding galaxies and just amazing things. And I think that stimulates people's imagination and makes them wonder even more.
Well, I think so too. As you look at science over the next 10 years or so, where are we headed? What are some of the possible new finds?
Well, you can't really, you can extrapolate from what we've started working on, but from what's really new, you can't really say, and scientists who've tried have had a very bad track record. Stephen himself in the 80s said, I think it was in the mid-80s, he said that he expected that we would complete this string theory and the theory of the universe and have it all sewed up within 10 years, by the end of the century, he said.
Because we haven't had anything new in string theory, and God, it sounds like a decade.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And what's funny is that Stephen made that prediction, and in the early 2000s, I asked him, I said, hey, Stephen, you said in the 1980s that we would have the answers by the end of the century. What do you have to say about that? And he said, I still say that. Of course, it's a new century. So string theory, it seems to be stagnating, and who knows, where it's going. You never know when a great breakthrough is going to happen. But I was having a conversation. I was at a conference in Europe recently, and I talked to a string theorist from England, a young guy, and he said there's a real generational gap there, and there's the older generation, which I guess I would be included in, who still see string theory as the original string theory, which has the goal of, Einstein's goal of unifying all of physics and showing why the laws are what they are. And he said that string theorists today, the young ones, don't see it that way. They have this other view, which is more like what I wrote about with Stephen in The Grand Design, which is that string theory will allow, it's a big structure that allows for many, many different universes. It's not going to tell us why the laws are what they are. It's just going to be a structure that we can put, you know, that we can fit our current, our universe into. And so that's a whole different approach. And he also said that that a lot of the younger string theorists are not really worried that much as I guess more traditional physicists were about finding that, you know, that smoking gun that shows that string theory is correct. And it's almost becoming a philosophy or a mathematical theory more than a concrete physics theory where you're really closely tied to experiment. And, you know, people have been working on it now since, well, it began around 1970, and still there's no, you know, direct evidence for it. Just a lot of nice mathematical evidence or mathematical observations.
In Leonard, where do other dimensions fit into any of this?
Well, see, when I was first at Caltech and John Schwartz was pushing string theory and everyone was laughing at him, Richard Feynman, the iconic physicist of that time, would see him in the hall. He'd say, "How many dimensions are you in today?"
That's right.
Right? Because it was first, see, string theory was only thought to be consistent at first in 26 dimensions, and then it was 10, and now with M theory, it's 11. But it clearly needs more dimensions than we actually have. So that gives you a quandary. Where are those other dimensions? You know, why don't we see them? And I'd get lost. I get lost in our four dimensions. So why don't we get lost? And so they have a smart answer for that, which is that the dimensions are very small. They're curled up. Think of a straw. If you look at a straw and you look at, say, the surface of a straw, it's two-dimensional. By that we mean to specify a point on the surface of the straw, I have to give you two pieces of information, say how far up along the straw it is, and if you go around it, how far around it is, that point, right?
Mm-hmm, right?
So it's two-dimensional. But if you look at the straw from a great distance, the kind of straw that you drink with looks like the kind of straw that you find on a farm. It looks so one-dimensional, like a line. And that circular dimension kind of disappears because it's so small and you're so far away. And that's what string theorists describe for these extra dimensions that we don't see that string theory demands. And, of course, the question is, do they really exist and how do we know? And string theorists are trying to find observational implications that they could test. And so far, no one's been successful. It doesn't mean that it's not true. But, you know, if you look through the history of science, there's always been this tension between having a theory that perhaps requires things that you don't see and calling that theory, you know, just a fudge thing full of fudge factors that isn't really true. Like Ptolemy had the theory where with the Earth being the center of the universe and everything goes around it. And, you know, people would look at the skies and they would find certain deviations. They would say, well, the stars don't really go in circles, or the planets, the sun doesn't really go in a circle. And he'd say, well, I can fix that because there's circles within the circle. So if you look at the sun, it's going on a big circle around the Earth, but it's actually going in a little circle around as it goes in that big circle. And then you can get even better description by putting smaller circles in those circles. And if you keep fudging it, you'll eventually get, you know, as accurate as you want. And that proved not to be the good way to look at it. On the other hand, in the 19th century, there were physicists who said that everything's made of atoms. And people again said, well, what are these atoms? We don't see the atoms. This is just fudge factors that you're putting in to, you know, make your theory work. But you know, you're postulating these crazy unseeable things that everything's made of, and that's not a good way of looking at it. You know, prove it. And, you know, that you couldn't prove it for 100 years. So the question is string theory like Ptolemy's circles upon circles, where it's just people have been fudging it and trying to make it work, but it's not really the way it works? Or is it like atoms, where oh, they made a real discovery, we just can't see it yet? And that's the question.
You know, Leonard, I want to talk with you a little bit later when we come back about chance in the universe and what's happening in that area. Leonard's website, he doesn't have, but you take a look at Stephen Hawking's, and of course, they're the co-authors of A Briefer History of Time. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll talk with Leonard about his new work, Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. When I come back with him in just a moment, let's talk a little bit about chance and what happens in the future. Hey, by the way, this weekend, I'm going to be in Vancouver, Canada, major speaking event, full details at our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. If you're in Vancouver, Canada, in that area, in the United States, get your passport. Come on up and see me. There's some tickets still available. Not a lot, but you still have a great selection for yourself to pick. And come on up. We'll be up there. Full details also at my calendar at coasttocoastam.com. Leonard, when you think of chance, what comes to mind?
Oh, my future. All our futures are largely governed, you know, by chance, much more than we realize. I'm not to say that our, you know, that we don't have some control, that your results aren't dependent on your hard work, your talent, and whatnot, your planning. But what people don't realize is that small things can have, you know, huge effects on what happens, and that even if things are well planned out, that doesn't guarantee your success. It's, you know, life is like a sports, like a baseball game, where the, you know, the lesser team can win on any given day, and it happens quite often.
Is chance the same as luck?
Well, yeah. I mean, luck is, I suppose, it's chance applied to your own, you know, to your own life. So if chance is working in your favor and good things happen to you, then you say that you have luck, right? And or if it's working the opposite way, you say you have bad luck. But yeah, luck in our lives comes from just what I said, the fact that there's a big random component in all our interactions in society.
Over the weekend, somebody in Florida won the Powerball, $590 million. That's got to be all luck, or is it all chance? What is that?
Yeah, well, that you know, that's luck. But, you know, in the drunkard's walk, I did an interesting calculation, and I said people get very excited. My father was one of them. He would go out and buy lottery tickets, all, you know, $2 lottery tickets, you know, every day, every week. And they think, oh, yeah, you know, someone has to win. It could be me. But I did a calculation, and I found that if you drive more than a mile to get your lottery ticket, then your chances of dying in a car accident on the way there or back are greater than winning your chances of winning the lottery. So you know, if you can walk there and don't cross any streets, maybe the chances are better. But, you know, someone's going to win, and I guess we all are optimists and think that could be us. I'll tell you one other thing my father taught me, though. He said, if they're paying out $500 million in the prize, you can be sure they're taking in a lot more than that in your
in,
you know,
profits. What, that's right.
Profits. So I don't think it's a winning proposition all in all.
Would you take the $590 minus whatever fees, of course, up front or over 20 years? There's a huge discount if you take it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a hard one. And I don't know the tax implications either. Maybe it's the same because you're.
Well, you might be. You're
so
knocked up
in
the 39% bracket.
You know, I would recommend to people, though, knowing the psychology that I do, that you should take it in a payout, you know, over time, because there's a huge tendency to, you know, lose it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Quickly, no matter how much comes in. Yeah,
that's right. So this way, you can get $20 million. You can. You know, by March, you get it in January. By March, you're broke again. But next January, you're going to get another 20 or something.
Of course, the downside is that state goes bankrupt, and you might be a, I don't know what happens to them.
Yeah, that could happen, too. So, see, chance plays a role.
I think I would take it up front.
You would?
I'm. You know what? I should do an Insta poll on our website. I might do that soon and just ask that question. Would you take it up front or over 20 years? And we'd have to, you know... You'd have to stipulate how much you would get. I think that would be a major factor in people's decision.
Yeah, and well, I suppose that they, well, that's an interesting question. Do they take into account some predicted inflation rate, or do they take into account the real, you know, the real change in the dollar? Yeah. I don't know.
My uncle years ago won $8 million in the Massachusetts lottery, and he elected to take $400,000 a year pre-tax over 20 years. And I think he's got maybe a year or two left, and then that's it. I don't know if he saved it. I didn't get any of it. And
wouldn't you still be doing what you're doing?
Absolutely.
You enjoy it. And you're good at it.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
If I won.
You won the lottery because you get to do something that
you
enjoy,
like.
That you're good at.
That's
and
right.
Anyone out there who is in that situation, and I feel I am, that you're blessed and you won the lottery.
If I won the 590. the 590, I'd still be doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know what? And it's amazing how many people go bankrupt who have won lotteries.
It is amazing. And there's also studies where they've, I don't know how they did this, but they've compared people's happiness before and after. And they found that it doesn't increase the people who have won the lottery. If you look at them a couple years later, presumably before they lost it all, they're no happier than they were before they won it.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, there comes a point with money, Leonard, I don't want to keep going down that direction, but, you know, if you can pay your bills and de-stress yourself, that's probably all you really need.
That is the biggest step, and that's the main thing. And so when they do those studies on happiness, they find that, of course, you have to, you know, if you can't do that, you're stressed out and unhappy. But for people who do that, the incremental happiness of more money isn't that great.
Let's get back to Chance for a little bit, because you cite an example of the Los Angeles Clippers firing their coach with a pretty darn good season based on their historical past.
Right, I think it was the best season ever. So you're going, boy, if you can't, that's a tough crowd if you can't keep your job when you had the best season ever. And, you know, what sports figures tend to do, and I gave a talk to the winter meeting recently of the Major League Baseball, all the general managers, you know, and they know this because their jobs are on the line. That
every year.
Yeah, and, it's very short-sighted to judge someone by a seven-game series. And, in fact, when I spoke to them, an example I gave was that suppose that your team is a 55% chance of winning the series. The other team is 45. So in baseball, that's a big difference, you know, 550 winning percentage versus 450. And so you had a great team. You did, as a general manager, a tremendous job building up that team. You got to the World Series. You're that much better than the other guy. Well, in a seven-game series, the inferior team in that situation will still have a 40% chance of winning the series. So you'd be fired for that? That's just the way life works. If you want to have a series where the chances of the inferior team winning are less than, let's say, 5%, which is what we call statistical significance in mathematics, you have to play a 296-game series.
Jeez.
No one would sit still for that. But then you could say, okay, you're fired, because that series pretty much shows that your team is no good. But, you know, to go into a seven-game series and the Clippers, I guess, lost in six, and to fire him because they lost in the first round is just ridiculous. And I feel bad for the coach. Of course, he'll get another job and do quite well.
Yeah, but I think he was having problems with his players, Leonard. I think the players wanted him out.
Yeah.
And ownership backed the players, which...
One player in particular, I guess, right?
Yes, so, absolutely. You know your sports.
A little bit.
Good for you. How did you get interested in science and physics? I mean, you got a PhD from Berkeley in physics. How'd you get interested?
Oh, you know, I think that you can see kids' destinies as when they're kids, people's destinies as a child. You know, and I loved science. You know, in fifth grade, I was learning algebra. I built a chemistry lab in my basement. In sixth grade, I memorized the periodic table. I mean, I was just a nerd. You know, and I just thought it was all the greatest stuff. I was just so curious, and so it's just a question of where I'm going to land and what kind of science I'm going to do. And if you look at other physicists, you know, they usually were tinkering around either with electronics or, you know, today physicists might end up, you know, making computer applications and becoming multi-zillionaires. But, you know, you get drawn into that pretty early. And, you know, and I also, by the way, have been writing stories since I was very young. So, you know, I think when you look at kids, whatever their passion is, that will show up. And of course, that's if they have a passion. I think anybody who has a passion in life is very lucky. So, you know, I just kind of, went along and picked physics. But, you know, I picked physics because I'm really very interested in math. And so that was turned out to be the science for me.
Did you see where they're getting applicants to go to Mars?
And of course, space travel, if you look, you know, I don't know how long it'll be, 10 years, 20 years down the road, it's going to be something that you do as a tourist, right? So I think just like airplanes, if you looked at 1905, I suppose people were wondering, what's this good for? And of course, the first thing it was used for is bombing other people. But it, you know, became something for wealthy people. And, you know, when I was in the 60s, when I was a kid, it was a big thrill, a big you know, a big thing to with my family, which wasn't wealthy, to be able to ride on a plane. And now anybody, you know, people are flying everywhere. And I guess that's where it's going to happen with space. Now, getting to Mars is a little bit of a bigger, you know, it's a little bit of a bigger task. But I guess eventually we'll do that. And I know Stephen Hawking thinks very much that our future is in space.
I don't think I could do that. I mean, it would be great to go to the moon or something, but I could not go to the Mars, live in a pod for the rest of my life.
Well, you know, you don't know how the technology will get to how fast we'll be able to get there. So, you know, I think the first thing to worry about on that trip right now is the radiation.
Yeah. I mean, if I could come back anytime I wanted, I would go.
Yeah, well, I know that they talked about sending, you know, because it's so hard to send the fuel there, that the easiest thing would be to send people there and have them stay, right? Because, you know, you take off from the Earth and you get a certain, once you're moving, Newton's laws tells you that you'll keep moving. You don't have to keep pumping up the speed. You can just go at whatever speed you're at until you get there. But then once you're there, you land, you stop, and you want to take off again, you need that fuel again. And you know, with current technology, that's a tough one because it's heavy. And so they're talking about sending people there who would stay there. And I'm with you there. Although if they could send me to another star, I've often thought maybe I'd go because I'm so curious. If I could go there, I couldn't come back. Huh. I still might go just to check it out.
Yeah, yeah. You never know. Earlier, we talked about the future of computers. At what point does it happen and go too far? We're not there yet, obviously, but
well, you know, the thing is, it goes too far when the government or even other people start intruding on you with it. You know, these Google Glasses, for instance, are, you know, just
and tell me what these things are.
Well, I wasn't picked to have one, but what they are basically your phone. You know, they've sold them now for I think $1,500 in a limited edition to certain people to test them out. And it's basically you have a camera, you have basically a smartphone on the glasses frames. In other words, you don't really have lenses in there. I guess you could, but the device is on frames that you wear, and then you can touch them in different ways, and you can very sneakily, you know, shoot videos or take pictures or, you know, and of course that's just going to get easier and easier to do. But people will be able to track you. You'll be able to track them. The people are working on face recognition software. I have a friend in Japan who was a pioneer in having cameras that can at least tell what is a face. You know, that was the first step. Sony wanted to have a camera that could pick out the face and crowd and focus on it, and that's, you know, like a smart camera. And then it could pick out whether you're smiling, and now they can pick out who you are. And wow, you know, that's like, you remember the old book 1984?
George Orwell.
Yeah, George Orwell.
He's so turning in his grave.
He's probably self-satisfied that he's predicted what's going on. You know, look at, if you go to England and there's cameras everywhere, kind of weird.
Well, you know, with the Google Glass, which is this wearable computer, how do you see the information, or do you?
No, there's a display that, you know, is very close to your eye, so you can look at it and see it. Like,
I assume if you're driving and you wear these, you can't drive.
One would assume that but you know, they're putting DVD players in the front seats of cars now, aren't they, and TVs, and it's scary. You're not supposed to. That's supposed to be for the passenger, but yeah, I mean, I don't know how they could keep you from wearing them while you're driving or using them. You know, once you have these technologies, people will do silly things.
I mean, are these things, these eyeglasses, are they going to be big things?
Well, I mean, Google thinks so. They invest a lot of money in that, but no one knows. I think Google is still trying to figure out what people are going to use it for and how much they, you know, how attractive they are to people. But whether it's this particular form or a shoe phone like we used to have in Get Smart or whatever,
exactly.
Whatever form it takes, you know, the idea that you're going to have to carry around the computer is becoming outmoded quickly. The computers are going to be, you know, it's only the interface that you have to worry about, which is why it's smart to put it in glasses, because it's right against your eye and it can be very small, but you're looking at it closely, right? But that's the only question, because you can actually fit the computers and, you know, they're getting so small, you don't really need something that you have to carry around. So people are going to figure out exactly what's the best way for us to, you know, to use that capability. But, it's going to be a little weird, I think.
Why are some places banning the use of wearing these things?
For instance, in Las Vegas, they're banning the use because they don't want you, you know, you could use those glasses to, send a video to somebody of the cards that you're, say, you're getting in blackjack, and then you have your card counter somewhere else, keeping track, keeping a spreadsheet, you know, and then getting the information back to you on what to do. So they don't, you know, I think they don't like that in Las Vegas. And, you know, some people are sensitive about being photographed or videotaped when they're not aware of it, which I can understand as well. I mean, if you have a smartphone, you can be a little, you can try to be a little subtle about it, but people can see you're pointing a phone at them, you know. But with the glasses, you just, your face is pointed at them, and they don't know if, you know, there's a light on it that says when the video is is recording, but of course people can probably figure out how to turn that off.
Amazing technology.
It is, yeah, it is.
Too much, actually.
Well, I don't know. I always, you know, when people say that, I know people who say, oh, I refuse to use this or that, the newest thing. And I go, yeah, but just think of when you were a kid and someone said, I refuse to use the telephone, some old guy, you know, I remember, we don't need this telephone, you know, just shout, send a letter. And, you know, you thought, oh, what an old fogey. And, you know, that's what people might think of us, too, if we don't, you know, if we resist these things.
Well, we're going to have cars that run by themselves. We already have some of them. But, I mean, it'll be, I think, mass-produced one day where just, you know, program where they're going, sit back, and let the car do all the driving.
Oh, yeah. You know, DARPA, Defense Advanced Research, DARPA project, they funded research into that because the military is very interested in having cars that are vehicles that can drive across land without a driver and without a preset map, so that they just use their GPS and they navigate around obstacles. And you can use technology like that, even simpler, to go on the roads. And I suppose we'll hopefully have better drivers when the computers. I mean, I look forward to sitting in the car and being able to, you know, use my computer as the car is taking me where I want to go and not worry about the crash.
Amazing. Just amazing how quickly things are happening. Indeed. Well, we're going to talk in a second about your subliminal work and where we're headed in that direction. Really quickly on the grand design, the book that you wrote, you got a lot of response to that, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even the Vatican, I think the Pope condemned us.
They all misinterpreted it.
Right. We didn't say that there's no God or that we're proving that there's no God. We were just saying what science says, and, you know, the rest is for you to decide. And as you said, in any case, we can never address the issue of where those laws come from. So, you know, I was surprised at the vehement reaction that we got in some quarters.
Well, you know what? Those things happen, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And, you know, that's okay. we can take it. But I mean, I guess the strange thing for me was I was on so many interviews after that, and all anyone wanted to talk about was that, which we didn't even say, about saying that there's no God, and we didn't even say that, and that's but sometimes, you know, George, that's the media.
Yeah,
is that a surprise?
Is right. That is right. Now, under subliminal, how your unconscious mind rules your behavior. Advertisers knew about this a long time ago, Leonard, didn't they?
Right, and you know, even before the science was there, I think they had their instincts about it, and so there's some, you know, fascinating studies now where scientists are imaging people's brains and seeing how the ads that say Coke has been running for the last decades are working and making people like Coke more than Pepsi.
No, you're right. We're going to come back. Let's talk about your new work in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.